They give you the upper hand. Now, leverage is the magic word, but it's also one of those concepts that negotiation experts casually throw about but rarely delve into, so I'd like to do so here. In theory, leverage is the ability to inflict loss and withhold gain. Where does your counterpart want to gain, and what do they fear losing? Discover these pieces of information, we are told, and you'll build leverage over the other side's perceptions, actions, and decisions. In practice, where our irrational perceptions are our reality, loss and gain are slippery notions, and it often doesn't matter what leverage actually exists against you. What really matters is the leverage they think you have on them. That's why I say there's always leverage. As an essentially emotional concept, it can be manufactured whether it exists or not. If they're talking to you, you have leverage. Who has leverage in a kidnapping? The kidnapper or the victim's family? Most people think the kidnapper has all the leverage. Sure, the kidnapper has something you love, but you have something they lust for. Which is more powerful? Moreover, how many buyers do the kidnappers have for the commodity they're trying to sell? What business is successful if there's only one buyer? Leverage has a lot of inputs, like time and necessity and competition. If you need to sell your house now, you have less leverage than if you don't have a deadline. If you want to sell it but don't have to, you have more. And if various people are bidding on it at once, good on you. I should note that leverage isn't the same thing as power. Donald Trump has tons of power. But if he's stranded in a desert and the owner of the only store for miles has the water he wants, the vendor has the leverage. One way to understand leverage is as a fluid that sloshes between the parties. As a negotiator, you should always be aware of which side, at any given moment, feels they have the most to lose if negotiations collapse. The party who feels they have more to lose and are the most afraid of that loss has less leverage, and vice versa. To get leverage, you have to persuade your counterpart that they have something real to lose if the deal falls through. At a taxonomic level, there are three kinds: positive, negative, and normative. Positive leverage. Positive leverage is quite simply your ability as a negotiator to provide or withhold things that your counterpart wants. Whenever the other side says, "I want," as in, "I want to buy your car," you have positive leverage. When they say that, you have power. You can make their desire come true, you can withhold it and thereby inflict pain, or you can use their desire to get a better deal with another party. Here's an example. 3 months after you've put your business on the market, a potential buyer finally tells you, "Yes, I'd like to buy it." You're thrilled, but a few days later, your joy turns to disappointment when he delivers an offer so low it's insulting. This is the only offer you have, so what do? Now, hopefully, you've had contact with other buyers, even casually. If you have, you can use the offer to create a sense of competition, and thereby kick off a bidding war. At least you'll force them to make a choice. But even if you don't have other offers, or the interested buyer is your first choice, you have more power than before your counterpart revealed his desire. You control what they want. That's why experienced negotiators delay making offers. They don't want to give up leverage. Positive leverage should improve your psychology during negotiation. You've gone from a situation where you want something from the investor to a situation where you both want something from each other. Once you have it, you can then identify other things your opponent wants. Maybe he wants to buy your firm over time. Help him do that, if he'll increase the price. Maybe his offer is all the money he has. Help him get what he wants, your business, by saying you can only sell him 75% for his offer. Negative leverage. Negative leverage is what most civilians picture when they hear the word leverage. It's a negotiator's ability to make his counterpart suffer. And it is based on threats. You have negative leverage if you can tell your counterpart, "If you don't fulfill your commitment, pay your bill, etc., I will destroy your reputation." This sort of leverage gets people's attention because of a concept we've discussed, loss aversion. As effective negotiators have long known, and psychologists have repeatedly proved, potential losses loom larger in the human mind than do similar gains. Getting a good deal may push us toward making a risky bet, but saving our reputation from destruction is a much stronger motivation. So what kind of black swans do you look to be aware of as negative leverage? Effective negotiators look for pieces of information, often obliquely revealed, that show what is important to their counterpart. Who is their audience? What signifies status and reputation to them? What most worries them? To find this information, one method is to go outside the negotiating table and speak to a third party that knows your counterpart. The most effective method is to gather it from interactions with your counterpart. That said, a word of warning. I do not believe in making direct threats, and am extremely careful with even subtle ones. Threats can be like nuclear bombs. There will be a toxic residue that will be difficult to clean up. You have to handle the potential of negative consequences with care, or you will hurt yourself and poison or blow up the whole process. If you shove your negative leverage down your counterpart's throat, it might be perceived as you taking away their autonomy. People will often sooner die than give up their autonomy. They'll at least act irrationally and shut off the negotiation. A more subtle technique is to label your negative leverage and thereby make it clear without attacking. Sentences like, "It seems like you strongly value the fact that you've always paid on time," or "It seems like you don't care what position you are leaving me in," can really open up the negotiation process. Normative leverage. Every person has a set of rules and a moral framework. Normative leverage is using the other party's norms and standards to advance your position. If you can show inconsistencies between their beliefs and their actions, you have normative leverage. No one likes to look like a hypocrite. For example, if your counterpart lets slip that they generally pay a certain multiple of cash flow when they buy a company, you can frame your desired price in a way that reflects that valuation. Discovering the black swans that give you normative valuation can be as easy as asking what your counterpart believes and listening openly. You want to see what language they speak and speak it back to them. Know their religion. In March 2003, I led the negotiation with a farmer who became one of the most unlikely post-9/11 terrorists you can imagine. The drama started when Dwight Watson, a North Carolina tobacco grower, hooked up his Jeep to a John Deere tractor festooned with banners and an inverted U.S. flag and towed it to Washington, D.C. to protest government policies he thought were putting tobacco farmers out of business. When Watson got to the Capitol, he pulled his tractor into a pond between the Washington Monument and the Vietnam Veterans Memorial and threatened to blow it up with the organophosphate bombs he claimed were inside. The Capitol went into lockdown as the police blocked off an 8-block area from the Lincoln Memorial to the Washington Monument. Coming just months after the Beltway sniper attacks and alongside the buildup to the Iraq War, the ease with which Watson threw the nation's capital into turmoil freaked people out. Talking on his cell phone, Watson told the Washington Post that he was on a do-or-die mission to show how reduced subsidies were killing tobacco farmers. He told the Post that God had instructed him to stage his protest, and he wasn't going to leave. "If this is the way America will be run, the hell with it," he said. "I will not surrender. They can blow me out of the water. I'm ready to go to heaven." The FBI deployed me to a converted RV on the National Mall, where I was to guide a team of FBI agents and U.S. Park Police as we tried to talk Watson out of killing himself, and who knows how many others. And then we got down to business. Like you'd expect of a negotiation with a guy threatening to destroy a good part of the U.S. Capitol, it was righteously tense. Sharpshooters had weapons trained on Watson, and they had the green light to shoot if he made any crazy moves. In any negotiation, but especially in a tense one like this, it's not how well you speak, but how well you listen that determines your success. Understanding the other is a precondition to be able to speak persuasively and develop options that resonate for them. There is the visible negotiation, and then all the things that are hidden under the surface, the secret negotiation space wherein the black swans dwell. Access to this hidden space very often comes through understanding the other side's worldview, their reason for being, their religion. Indeed, digging into your counterpart's religion, sometimes involving God, but not always, inherently implies moving beyond the negotiating table and into the life, emotional and otherwise, of your counterpart. Once you have understood your counterpart's worldview, you can build influence. That's why, as we talked with Watson, I spent my energy trying to unearth who he was rather than logically arguing him into surrender. From this, we learned that Watson had been finding it increasingly hard to make a living on his 1,200-acre tobacco farm, which had been in his family for 5 generations. After being hit by a drought and having his crop quota cut by half, Watson decided he couldn't afford the farm anymore and drove to Washington to make his point. He wanted attention, and knowing what he wanted gave us positive leverage. Watson also told us he was a veteran, and veterans had rules. This is the kind of music you want to hear, as it provides normative leverage. He told us that he would be willing to surrender, but not right away. As a military police officer in the 82nd Airborne in the 1970s, he'd learned that if he was trapped behind enemy lines, he could withdraw with honor if reinforcements didn't arrive within 3 days, but not before. Now we had articulated rules we could hold him to, and the admission that he could withdraw also implied that, despite his bluster about dying, he wanted to live. One of the first things you try to decide in a hostage negotiation is whether your counterpart's vision of the future involves them living. And Watson had answered yes. We used this information, a piece of negative leverage, as we could take away something he wanted, life, and started working it alongside the positive leverage of his desire to be heard. We emphasized to Watson that he had already made national news, and if he wanted his message to survive, he was going to have to live. Watson was smart enough to understand that there was a real chance he wouldn't make it out alive, but he still had his rules of military honor. His own desires and fears helped generate some positive and negative leverage, but they were secondary to the norms by which he lived his life. It was tempting to just wait until the 3rd day, but I doubted we'd get that far. With each passing hour, the atmosphere was growing tenser. The Capitol was under siege, and we had reason to believe he might have explosives. If he made one wrong move, one spastic freakout, the snipers would kill him. He'd already had several angry outbursts, so every hour that passed endangered him. He could still get himself killed. But we couldn't hit on that at all. We couldn't threaten to kill him and expect that to work. The reason for that is something called the paradox of power. Namely, the harder we push, the more likely we are to be met with resistance. That's why you have to use negative leverage sparingly. Still, time was short, and we had to speed things up. But how? What happened next was one of those glorious examples of how deeply listening to understand your counterpart's worldview can reveal a black swan that transforms a negotiation dynamic. Watson didn't directly tell us what we needed to know, but by close attention we uncovered a subtle truth that informed everything he said. About 36 hours in, Winnie Miller, an FBI agent on our team who'd been listening intently to subtle references Watson had been making, turned to me. "He's a devout Christian," she told me. "Tell him tomorrow is the dawn of the 3rd day. That's the day Christians believe Jesus Christ left his tomb and ascended to heaven. If Christ came out on the dawn of the 3rd day, why not Watson?" It was a brilliant use of deep listening. By combining that subtext of Watson's words with the knowledge of his worldview, she let us show Watson that we not only were listening, but that we had also heard him. If we'd understood his subtext correctly, this would let him end the standoff honorably, and to do so with the feeling that he was surrendering to an adversary that respected him and his beliefs. By positioning your demands within the worldview your counterpart uses to make decisions, you show them respect, and that gets you attention and results. Knowing your counterpart's religion is more than just gaining normative leverage per se. Rather, it's gaining a holistic understanding of your counterpart's worldview, in this case, literally a religion, and using that knowledge to inform your negotiating moves. Using your counterpart's religion is extremely effective in large part because it has authority over them. The other guy's religion is what the market, the experts, God, or society, whatever matters to him, has determined to be fair and just, and people defer to that authority. In the next conversation with Watson, we mentioned that the next morning was the dawn of the third day. There was a long moment of silence on the other end of the line. Our negotiation operations center was so quiet you could hear the heartbeat of the guy next to you. Watson coughed. "I'll come out," he said. And he did, ending a 48-hour standoff, saving himself from harm, and allowing the nation's capital to resume its normal life. No explosives were found. While the importance of knowing their religion should be clear from Watson's story, here are two tips for reading religion correctly. Review everything you hear. You will not hear everything the first time, so double-check. Compare notes with your team members. You will often discover new information that will help you advance the negotiation. Use backup listeners whose only job is to listen between the lines. They will hear things you miss. In other words, listen, listen again, and listen some more. We've seen how a holistic understanding of your counterpart's religion, a huge black swan, can provide normative leverage that leads to negotiating results. But there are other ways in which learning your counterpart's religion enables you to achieve better outcomes. The similarity principle. Research by social scientists has confirmed something effective negotiators have known for ages. Namely, we trust people more when we view them as being similar or familiar. People trust those who are in their in-group. Belonging is a primal instinct, and if you can trigger that instinct, that sense that, oh, we see the world the same way, then you immediately gain influence. When our counterpart displays attitudes, beliefs, ideas, even modes of dress that are similar to our own, we tend to like and trust them more. Similarities as shallow as club memberships or college alumni status increase rapport. That's why in many cultures, negotiators spend large amounts of time building rapport before they even think of offers. Both sides know that the information they glean could be vital to effective deal-making and leverage-building. It's a bit like dogs circling each other, smelling each other's behind. I once worked a deal for our services with this CEO in Ohio, where the similarity principle played a major role. My counterpart was constantly making references that I recognized as being sort of born-again Christian material. As we talked, he kept going back and forth on whether he should bring in his advisors. The whole issue of his advisors clearly pained him. At one point he even said, "Nobody understands me." At that moment I began to rack my brain for the Christian word that captured the essence of what he was saying. And then the term came to my mind— a term people often used in church to describe the duty one had to administer our own and our world's, and therefore God's, resources, with honesty, accountability, and responsibility. "This is really stewardship for you, isn't it?" I said. His voice immediately strengthened. "Yes! You're the only one who understands," he said. And he hired us at that moment. By showing that I understood his deeper reasons for being, and accessing a sense of similarity, a mutual belongingness, I was able to bring him to the deal. The minute I established a kind of shared identity with this Christian, we were in. Not simply because of similarity alone, but because of the understanding implied by that moment of similarity. The power of hopes and dreams. Once you know your counterpart's religion and can visualize what he truly wants out of life, you can employ those aspirations as a way to get him to follow you. Every engineer, every executive, every child, all of us want to believe we are capable of the extraordinary. As children, our daydreams feature ourselves as primary players in great moments, an actor winning an Oscar, an athlete hitting the game-winning shot. As we grow older, however, our parents, teachers, and friends talk more of what we can't and shouldn't do than what is possible, we begin to lose faith. But when someone displays a passion for what we've always wanted and conveys a purposeful plan of how to get there, we allow our perceptions of what's possible to change. We're all hungry for a map to joy, and when someone is courageous enough to draw it for us, we naturally follow. So when you ascertain your counterpart's unattained goals, invoke your own power and followability by expressing passion for their goals and for their ability to achieve them. Ted Leonsis is great at this. As the owner of the Washington Wizards professional basketball team and the Washington Capitals professional hockey team, he is always talking about creating the immortal moments in sports that people will tell their grandchildren about. Who doesn't want to come to an agreement with someone who is going to make them an immortal? Religion as a reason. Research studies have shown that people respond favorably to requests made in a reasonable tone of voice and followed with a because reason. In a famous study from the late 1970s, Harvard psychology professor Ellen Langer and her colleagues approached people waiting for copy machines and asked if they could cut the line. Sometimes they gave a reason, sometimes they didn't. What she found was crazy. Without her giving a reason, 60% let her through. But when she did give one, more than 90% did. And it didn't matter if the reason made sense. "Excuse me, I have 5 pages. May I cut in line because I have to make copies?" Worked great. People just responded positively to the framework. While idiotic reasons worked with something simple like photocopying, on more complicated issues you can increase your effectiveness by offering reasons that reinforce your counterpart's religion. Had that Christian CEO offered me a lowball offer when he agreed to hire my firm, I might have answered, "I'd love to, but I too have a duty to be a responsible steward of my resources." It's not crazy, it's a clue. It's not human nature to embrace the unknown. It scares us. When we are confronted by it, we ignore it, we run away, or we label it in ways that allow us to dismiss it. In negotiations, that label most often takes the form of the statement, "They're crazy." That's one reason I've been highly critical of some of the implementation of America's hostage negotiation policy, which is that we don't negotiate with those we refer broadly to as the terrorists, including groups from the Taliban to ISIS. The rationale for this non-engagement is summarized well by the journalist Peter Bergen, CNN's national security analyst. Negotiations with religious fanatics who have delusions of grandeur generally do not go well. The alternative we've chosen is to not understand their religion, their fanaticism, and their delusions. Instead of negotiations that don't go well, we shrug our shoulders and say, "They're crazy." But that's absolutely wrong-headed. We must understand these things. I'm not saying that because I'm a soft-headed pacifist. The FBI doesn't hire agents like that. But because I know understanding such things is the best way to discover the other side's vulnerabilities and wants and thereby gain influence. You can't get that stuff unless you talk. No one is immune to "they're crazy." You can see it rear its head in every kind of negotiation, from parenting to congressional deal-making to corporate bargaining. But the moment when we're most ready to throw our hands up and declare "they're crazy" is often the best moment for discovering black swans that transform a negotiation. It is when we hear or see something that doesn't make sense, something crazy, that a crucial fork in the road is presented. Push forward, even more forcefully, into that which we initially can't process, or take the other path, the one to guaranteed failure, in which we tell ourselves that negotiating was useless anyway. In their great book, Negotiation Genius, Harvard Business School professors Deepak Malhotra and Max H. Bazerman provide a look at the common reasons negotiators mistakenly call their counterparts crazy. I'd like to talk through them here. Mistake number one, they are ill-informed. Often the other side is acting on bad information, and when people have bad information, they make bad choices. There's a great computer industry term for this, GIGO, garbage in, garbage out. As an example, Malhotra talks about a student of his who was in a dispute with an ex-employee who claimed he was owed $130,000 in commissions for work he had done before being fired. He was threatening a lawsuit. Confused, the executive turned to the company's accountants. There he discovered the problem. The accounts had been a mess when the employee was fired, but had since been put into order. With the clean information, the accountants assured the executive that, in fact, the employee owed the company $25,000. Eager to avoid a lawsuit, the executive called the employee, explained the situation, and made an offer. If the employee dropped the lawsuit, he could keep the $25,000. To his surprise, the employee said that he was going forward with the suit anyway. He acted irrational. Crazy. Malhotra told his student that the problem was not craziness, but a lack of information and trust. So the executive had an outside accounting firm audit the numbers and send the results to the employee. The result? The employee dropped the suit. The clear point here is that people operating with incomplete information appear crazy to those who have different information. Your job when faced with someone like this in a negotiation is to discover what they do not know and supply that information. Mistake number two, they are constrained. In any negotiation where your counterpart is acting wobbly, there exists a distinct possibility that they have things they can't do but aren't eager to reveal. Such constraints can make the sanest counterpart seem irrational. The other side might not be able to do something because of legal advice or because of promises already made, or even to avoid setting a precedent. Or they may just not have the power to close the deal. That last situation is one that a client of mine faced as he was trying to land Coca-Cola as a client for his marketing firm. The guy had been negotiating a deal for months, and it was getting on to November. He was petrified that if he didn't close it before the calendar year ended, he would have to wait for Coca-Cola to set a new budget, and he might lose the client. The problem was that his contact had suddenly stopped responding. So we told him to send a version of our classic email for non-responders, the one that always works. Have you given up on finalizing this deal this year? Then something weird happened. The Coca-Cola contact didn't respond to the perfect email. What was up? This was superficially quite irrational, but the contact had been a straight-up guy until then. We told our client this could only mean one thing, that the guy had given up on closing the deal by the end of the year, but he didn't want to admit it. There had to be some constraint. With this knowledge in hand, we had our client dig deep. After a batch of phone calls and emails, he tracked down someone who knew his contact. And it turned out we had been right. The contact's division had been in chaos for weeks, and in the midst of corporate infighting, he had completely lost influence. Not surprisingly, he was embarrassed to admit it. That's why he was avoiding my client. To put it simply, he had major constraints. Mistake number three. They have other interests. Think back to William Griffin, the first man ever to kill a hostage on deadline. What the FBI and police negotiators on the scene simply did not know was that his main interest was not negotiating a deal to release the hostages for money. He wanted to be killed by a cop. Had they been able to dig up that hidden interest, they might have been able to avoid some of that day's tragedy. The presence of hidden interests isn't as rare as you might think. Your counterpart will often reject offers for reasons that have nothing to do with their merits. A client may put off buying your product so that their calendar year closes before the invoice hits, increasing his chance for a promotion. Or an employee might quit in the middle of a career-making project just before bonus season because he or she has learned that colleagues are making more money. For that employee, fairness is as much an interest as money. Whatever the specifics of the situation, these people are not acting irrationally. They are simply complying with needs and desires that you don't yet understand, what the world looks like to them based on their own set of rules. Your job is to bring these black swans to light. As we've seen, when you recognize that your counterpart is not irrational but simply ill-informed, constrained, or obeying interests that you do not yet know, your field of movement greatly expands, and that allows you to negotiate much more effectively. Here are a few ways to unearth these powerful black swans. Get FaceTime. Black swans are incredibly hard to uncover if you're not literally at the table. No matter how much research you do, there's just some information that you are not going to find out unless you sit face to face. Today, a lot of younger people do almost everything over email. It's just how things are done. But it's very difficult to find black swans with email for the simple reason that, even if you knock your counterpart off their moorings with great labels and calibrated questions, email gives them too much time to think and recenter themselves to avoid revealing too much. In addition, email doesn't allow for tone of voice effects, and it doesn't let you read the nonverbal parts of your counterpart's response. Remember 73855. Let's return now to the tale of my client who was trying to get Coca-Cola as a client, only to learn that his contact at the company had been pushed aside. I realized that the only way my client was going to get a deal with Coca-Cola was by getting his contact to admit that he was useless for the situation and pass my client on to the correct executive. But there was no way this guy wanted to do that, because he still imagined that he could be important. So I told my client to get his contact out of the Coca-Cola complex. You gotta get him to dinner. You're going to say, "Would it be a bad idea for me to take you to your favorite steakhouse and we just have a few laughs and we don't talk business?" The idea was that no matter the reason, whether the contact was embarrassed or didn't like my client or just didn't want to discuss the situation, the only way the process was going to move forward was through direct human interaction. So my client got this guy out for dinner, and as promised, he didn't bring up business. But there was no way not to talk about it. And just because my client created personal face-to-face interaction, the contact admitted he was the wrong guy. He admitted that his division was a mess, and he'd have to hand things off to somebody else to get the deal done. And he did. It took more than a year to get the deal signed, but they did it. Observe unguarded moments. While you have to get face time, formal business meetings, structured encounters, and planned negotiating sessions are often the least revealing kinds of face time because these are the moments when people are at their most guarded. Hunting for black swans is also effective during unguarded moments at the fringes, whether at meals, like my client had with his Coca-Cola contact, or the brief moments of relaxation before or after formal interactions. During a typical business meeting, the first few minutes before you actually get down to business, and the last few minutes, as everyone is leaving, often tell you more about the other side than anything in between. That's why reporters have a credo to never turn off their recorders. You always get the best stuff at the beginning and the end of an interview. Also, pay close attention to your counterpart during interruptions, odd exchanges, or anything that interrupts the flow. When someone breaks ranks, people's facades crack just a little. Simply noticing who cracks and how others respond verbally and non-verbally can reveal a gold mine. When it doesn't make sense, there's sense, C-E-N-T-S, to be made. Students often ask me whether black swans are specific kinds of information or any kind that helps. I always answer that they are anything that you don't know that changes things. To drive this home, here's the story of one of my MBA students who was interning for a private equity real estate firm in Washington. Faced with actions from his counterpart that didn't pass the sense test, he innocently turned up one of the greatest black swans I've seen in years by using a label. My student had been performing due diligence on potential targets when a principal at the firm asked him to look into a mixed-use property in the heart of Charleston, South Carolina. He had no experience in the Charleston market, so he called the broker selling the property and requested the marketing package. After discussing the deal and the market, my student and his boss decided that the asking price of $4.3 million was about $450,000 too high. At that point, my student called the broker again to discuss pricing and next steps. After initial pleasantries, the broker asked my student what he thought of the property. "It looks like an interesting property," he said. "Unfortunately, we don't know the market fundamentals. We like downtown and King Street in particular, but we have a lot of questions." The broker then told him that he had been in the market for more than 15 years, so he was well informed. At this point, my student pivoted to calibrated how and what questions in order to gather information and judge the broker's skills. "Great," my student said. "First and foremost, How has Charleston been affected by the economic downturn? The broker replied with a detailed answer, citing specific examples of market improvement. In the process, he showed my student that he was very knowledgeable. "It sounds like I'm in good hands," he said, using a label to build empathy. Next question, what sort of cap rate can be expected in this type of building? Through the ensuing back and forth, my student learned that owners could expect rates of 6 to 7% because buildings like this were popular with students at the local university, a growing school where 60% of the student body lived off campus. He also learned that it would be prohibitively expensive, if not physically impossible, to buy land nearby and build a similar building. In the last 5 years, no one had built on the street because of historic preservation rules. Even if they could buy land, the broker said a similar building would cost $2.5 million just in construction. The building is in great shape, especially compared to the other options available to students, the broker said. It seems like this building functions more as a glorified dormitory than a classic multifamily building, my student said, using a label to extract more information. And he got it. Fortunately and unfortunately, yes, the broker said. The occupancy has historically been 100%, and it is a cash cow, but the students act like college students. A light bulb went on in my student's head. There was something strange afoot. If it were such a cash cow, why would someone sell a 100% occupied building located next to a growing campus in an affluent city? That was irrational by any measure. A little befuddled, but still in the negotiation mindset, my student constructed a label. Inadvertently, he mislabeled the situation, triggering the broker to correct him and reveal a black swan. If he or she is selling such a cash cow, it seems like the seller must have doubts about future market fundamentals, he said. Well, he said, the seller has some tougher properties in Atlanta and Savannah, so he has to get out of this property to pay back the other mortgages. Bingo. With that, my student had unearthed a fantastic black swan. The seller was suffering constraints that, until that moment, had been unknown. My student put the broker on mute as he described other properties and used the moment to discuss pricing with his boss. He quickly gave him the green light to make a lowball offer, an extreme anchor, to try to yank the broker to his minimum. After quizzing the broker if the seller would be willing to close quickly and getting a yes, my student set his anchor. I think I have heard enough, he said. We are willing to offer $3.4 million. Okay, the broker answered. That is well below the asking price. However, I can bring the offer to the seller and see what he thinks. Later that day, the broker came back with a counteroffer. The seller had told him that the number was too low, but he was willing to take $3.7 million. My student could barely keep from falling off his chair. The counteroffer was lower than his goal, but rather than jump at the amount and risk leaving value on the table with a wimp-win deal, my student pushed further. He said no without using the word. That is closer to what we believe the value to be, he said, but we cannot in good conscience pay more than $3.55 million. Later, my student told me, and I agreed, that he should have used a label or calibrated question here to push the broker to bid against himself. But he was so surprised by how far the price had dropped that he stumbled into old-school haggling. I'm only authorized to go down to $3.6 million, the broker answered, clearly showing that he'd never taken a negotiation class that taught the Ackerman model and how to pivot to terms to avoid the haggle. My student's boss signaled to him that $3.6 million worked, and he agreed to the price. I've teased several of the techniques my student used to effectively negotiate a great deal for his firm, from the use of labels and calibrated questions to the probing of constraints to unearth a beautiful black swan. It also bears noting that my student did tons of work beforehand and had prepared labels and questions so that he was ready to jump on the black swan when the broker offered it. Once he knew that the seller was trying to get money out of this building to pay off mortgages on the underperforming ones, he knew that timing was important. Of course, there's always room for improvement. Afterward, my student told me he wished he hadn't lowballed the offer so quickly and instead used the opportunity to discuss the other properties. He might have found more investment opportunities within the seller's portfolio. In addition, He could have potentially built more empathy and teased out more unknown unknowns with labels or calibrated questions like, what markets are you finding difficult right now? Maybe even gotten FaceTime with the seller directly. Still, well done. Overcoming fear and learning to get what you want out of life. People generally fear conflict, so they avoid useful arguments out of fear that the tone will escalate into personal attacks they cannot handle. People in close relationships often avoid making their own interests known and instead compromise across the board to avoid being perceived as greedy or self-interested. They fold, they grow bitter, and they grow apart. We've all heard of marriages that ended in divorce, and the couple never fought. Families are just an extreme version of all parts of humanity, from government to business. Except for a few naturals, everyone hates negotiation at first. Your hands sweat, your fight or flight kicks in, with a strong emphasis on flight, and your thoughts trip drunkenly over themselves. The natural first impulse for most of us is to chicken out, throw in the towel, run. The mere idea of tossing out an extreme anchor is traumatic. That's why wimp-win deals are the norm in the kitchen and in the boardroom. But stop and think about that. Are we really afraid of the guy across the table? I can promise you that, with very few exceptions, he's not going to reach across and slug you. No, our sweaty palms are just an expression of physiological fear. A few trigger-happy neurons firing because of something more base. Our innate human desire to get along with other members of the tribe. It's not the guy across the table who scares us. It's conflict itself. If this book accomplishes only one thing, I hope it gets you over that fear of conflict and encourages you to navigate it with empathy. If you're going to be great at anything, a great negotiator, a great manager, a great husband, a great wife, you're going to have to do that. You're going to have to ignore that little genie who's telling you to give up, to just get along, as well as that other genie who's telling you to lash out and yell. You're going to have to embrace regular, thoughtful conflict as the basis of effective negotiation and of life. Please remember that our emphasis throughout the book is that the adversary is the situation, and that the person you appear to be in conflict with is actually your partner. More than a little research has shown that genuine, honest conflict between people over their goals actually helps energize the problem-solving process in a collaborative way. Skilled negotiators have a talent for using conflict to keep the negotiation going without stumbling into personal battle. Remember, pushing hard for what you believe is not selfish. It is not bullying. It is not just helping you. Your amygdala, the part of the brain that processes fear, will try to convince you to give up, to flee, because the other guy is right, or you're being cruel. But if you are an honest, decent person looking for a reasonable outcome, you can ignore the amygdala. With the style of negotiation taught in the book, an information-obsessed, empathetic search for the best possible deal, you are trying to uncover value, period. Not to strong-arm or to humiliate. When you ask calibrated questions, yes, you are leading your counterpart to your goals, but you are also leading them to examine and articulate what they want and why and how they can achieve it. You are demanding creativity of them, and therefore pushing them toward a collaborative solution. When I bought my Red 4Runner, no doubt I disappointed the salesman by giving him a smaller payday than he would have liked. But I helped him reach his quota, and no doubt I paid more for the truck than the car lot had paid Toyota. If all I'd wanted was to win, to humiliate, I would have stolen the thing. And so I'm going to leave you with one request. Whether it's in the office or around the family dinner table, don't avoid honest, clear conflict. It will get you the best car price, the higher salary, and the largest donation. It will also save your marriage, your friendship, and your family. One can only be an exceptional negotiator and a great person by both listening and speaking clearly and empathetically, by treating counterparts and oneself with dignity and respect, and most of all by being honest about what one wants and what one can and cannot do. Every negotiation, every conversation, every moment of life is a series of small conflicts that, managed well, can rise to creative beauty. Embrace them. Key lessons. What we don't know can kill us or our deals, but uncovering it can totally change the course of a negotiation and bring us unexpected success. Finding the black swans, those powerful unknown unknowns, is intrinsically difficult, however, for the simple reason that we don't know the question to ask. Because we don't know what the treasure is, we don't know where to dig. Here are some of the best techniques for flushing out the black swans and exploiting them. Remember, your counterpart might not even know how important the information is or even that they shouldn't reveal it. So keep pushing, probing, and gathering information. Let what you know, your known knowns, guide you but not blind you. Every case is new, so remain flexible and adaptable. Remember the Griffin Bank crisis. No hostage taker had killed a hostage on deadline until he did. Black swans are leverage multipliers. Remember the three types of leverage. Positive, the ability to give someone what they want. Negative, the ability to hurt someone. And normative, using your counterpart's norms to bring them around. Work to understand the other side's religion. Digging into worldviews inherently implies moving beyond the negotiating table and into the life, emotional and otherwise, of your counterpart. That's where black swans live. Review everything you hear from your counterpart. You will not hear everything the first time, so double-check. Compare notes with team members. Use backup listeners whose job is to listen between the lines. They will hear things you miss. Exploit the similarity principle. People are more apt to concede to someone they share a cultural similarity with, so dig for what makes them tick and show that you share common ground. When someone seems irrational or crazy, they most likely aren't. Faced with this situation, search for constraints, hidden desires, and bad information. Get FaceTime with your counterpart. 10 minutes of FaceTime often reveals more than days of research. Pay special attention to your counterpart's verbal and nonverbal communication at unguarded moments, at the beginning and the end of the session, or when someone says something out of line. Acknowledgements. This book would not have been possible without my son Brandon's help. Brandon has been involved in helping me shape and create these ideas since I first began teaching at Georgetown University. He was initially just there to video record the classes, but he also provided me feedback on how it was going and what was working. To be fair, he actually has been negotiating with me since he was 2 years old. I think I've known that ever since I found out he was using empathy to get out of trouble with his vice principal in high school. In my first meeting with my brilliant co-writer, Tal Raz, Brandon was there to keep the information flow going as Tal soaked it up. In the first progress conference call with my amazing publisher, Hollis Heimbach, Hollis asked about Brandon's role, and Tal said having Brandon around was like having another Chris in the room. Brandon has been indispensable. Tal Raz is a flat-out genius. Anyone who writes a business book without him hasn't gotten as far as they could have. It's that simple. I can't believe how smart he is or how quickly he gets it. He is a true business writing artist. He's a great person as well. Steve Ross, my agent, is a man of integrity and was perfect for this book. He has great industry knowledge and made this book happen. I am grateful to know him. Hollis Heimbach rocks. I am thrilled that she led the HarperCollins team and believed enough in this book to buy it. Thank you, Hollis. Thank you, Maya Stevenson, for coming onto the Black Swan team and holding us together. We are going farther because of you. Sheila Heen and John Richardson are two amazing people. They are the ones who really paved the way to show that these hostage negotiation ideas belong in the business world. Sheila was my teacher at Harvard Law School. She inspired me with how she taught and who she is. She asked me to teach alongside her 2 years later. John asked me to teach international business negotiation at Harvard alongside him a year after that. He guided me through that process, which led to the opportunity to become an adjunct at Georgetown. When nothing was happening for me, both John and Sheila were there. Without them, I don't know where I'd be. Thank you both. Gary Noesner was my mentor at the FBI. He inspired and remade the hostage negotiation world with the help of his team at the Crisis Negotiation Unit, CNU. He supported me in whatever I wanted to do. He made me the FBI's lead international kidnapping negotiator. I could call Gary at 5 a.m. and tell him I was getting on a plane in 3 hours to go to a kidnapping, and he would say go. His support never wavered. At CNU, he pulled together the most talented collection of hostage negotiators ever assembled. CNU hit its zenith when we were there. None of us knew how lucky we were. John Flood, Vince D'Alfonso, Chuck Regini, Winnie Miller, Manny Suarez, Dennis Braden, Neil Pertell, and Steve Romano were all rock stars. I learned from you all. I can't believe what Chuck put up with from me as my partner. Dennis was my mentor and great friend. I constantly clashed with Vince and grew because of his talent. All those who were on the FBI critical incident negotiation team during that time taught me as well. Thank you. Tommy Corrigan and John Ligori were my brothers when I was in New York City. The three of us did extraordinary things together. I'm inspired by the memory of Tommy Corrigan to this day. I was privileged to be a member of the Joint Terrorist Task Force. We fought evil. Richie DiFilippo and Charlie Bodwin were exceptional wingmen on the crisis negotiation team. Thank you both for all you taught me. Hugh McGowan and Bob Loudon from the NYPD's hostage negotiation team shared their wisdom with me. Both of you have been indispensable assets to the hostage negotiation world. Thank you. Derek Gaunt has been a great wingman in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. Derek gets it. Thank you, Derek. Kathy Ellingsworth and her late husband Bill have been dear friends and a sounding board for years. I am grateful for your support and friendship. Tom Strenz is the godfather of the FBI's hostage crisis negotiation program and has been an unwavering friend. I can't believe he still takes my calls. My students at Georgetown and USC have constantly proved that these ideas work everywhere. More than one student has stopped breathing when I looked at them and said, "I need a car in 60 seconds or she dies." Thanks for coming along for the ride. Georgetown and USC have both been phenomenal places to teach. Both are truly dedicated to higher learning, the highest academic standards, and the success of their students. The hostages and their families who allowed me in during their darkest hours to try to help are all blessed people. I am grateful to still be in touch with some of you today. What wisdom there is in the universe that decided your paths were necessary, I don't understand. I was blessed by your grace. I need all the help I can get. Appendix. Prepare a negotiation one sheet. Negotiation is a psychological investigation. You can gain a measure of confidence going into such an investigation with a simple preparatory exercise we advise all our clients to do. Basically, it's a list of the primary tools you anticipate using, such as labels and calibrated questions, customized to the particular negotiation. When the pressure is on, you don't rise to the occasion. You fall to your highest level of preparation. One note of caution before going into greater depth on this exercise. Some negotiation experts fetishize preparation to such a degree that they advise people to create the equivalent of preordained scripts for exactly how the negotiation will unfold and the exact form and substance the agreement will take on. By now, after reading this far, you'll understand why that's a fool's errand. Not only will such an approach make you less agile and creative at the table, it will make you more susceptible to those who are. Based on my company's experiences, I believe that good initial preparation for each negotiation yields at least a 7-to-1 rate of return on time saved renegotiating deals or clarifying implementation. In the entertainment industry, they have a single document that summarizes a product for publicity and sales that they call a one-sheet. Along the same lines, we want to produce a negotiation one-sheet that summarizes the tools we are going to use. It will have 5 short sections. Section 1. The Goal. Think through best-worst-case scenarios, but only write down a specific goal that represents the best case. Typically, negotiation experts will tell you to prepare by making a list, your bottom line, what you really want, how you're going to try to get there, and counters to your counterpart's arguments. But this typical preparation fails in many ways. It's unimaginative and leads to the predictable bargaining dynamic of offer-counteroffer, meet in the middle. In other words, it gets results, but they're often mediocre. The centerpiece of the traditional preparation dynamic, and its greatest Achilles heel, is something called the BATNA. Roger Fisher and William Urey coined the term in their 1981 bestseller Getting to Yes, and it stands for Best Alternative to a Negotiated Agreement. Basically, it's the best possible option you have if negotiations fail. Your last resort. Say you're on a car lot trying to sell your old BMW 3 Series. If you already have another dealer who's given you a written offer for $10,000, that's your BATNA. The problem is that BATNA tricks negotiators into aiming low. Researchers have found that humans have a limited capacity for keeping focus in complex, stressful situations like negotiations. And so, once a negotiation is underway, we tend to gravitate toward the focus point that has the most psychological significance for us. In that context, obsessing over a BATNA turns it into your target, and thereby sets the upper limit of what you will ask for. After you've spent hours on a BATNA, you mentally concede everything beyond it. God knows aiming low is seductive. Self-esteem is a huge factor in negotiation, and many people set modest goals to protect it. It's easier to claim victory when you aim low. That's why some negotiation experts say that many people who think they have win-win goals really have wimp-win mentality. The wimp-win negotiator focuses on his or her bottom line, and that's where they end up. So if BATNA isn't your centerpiece, what should be? I tell my clients that as part of their preparation, they should think about the outcome extremes, best and worst. If you've got both ends covered, you will be ready for anything. So know what you cannot accept and have an idea about the best-case outcome, but keep in mind that since there's information yet to be acquired from the other side, it's quite possible that best case might be even better than you know. Remember, never be so sure of what you want that you wouldn't take something better. Once you've got flexibility in the forefront of your mind, you come into a negotiation with a winning mindset. Let's say you're selling old speakers because you need $100 to put toward a new set. If you concentrate on the $100 minimum, you'll relax when you hear that number, and that's what you'll get. But if you know that they are for sale in used audio stores for $140, you could set a high-end goal of $150 while remaining open to better things. Now, while I counsel thinking about a best-worst range to give my clients the security of some structure, when it comes to what actually goes on your one sheet, my advice is to just stick with the high-end goal, as it will motivate and focus your psychological powers, priming you to think you are facing a loss for any term that falls short. Decades of goal-setting research is clear that people who set specific challenging but realistic goals end up getting better deals than those who don't set goals or simply strive to do their best. Bottom line, people who expect more and articulate it get more. Here are the four steps for setting your goal. Set an optimistic but reasonable goal and define it clearly. Write it down. Discuss your goal with a colleague. This makes it harder to wimp out. Carry the written goal into the negotiation. Section 2. Summary. Summarize and write out in just a couple of sentences the known facts that have led up to the negotiation. You are going to have something to talk about beyond a self-serving assessment of what you want, and you had better be ready to respond with tactical empathy to your counterpart's arguments. Unless they're incompetent, the other party will come prepared to argue an interpretation of the facts that favors them. Get on the same page at the outset. You have to clearly describe the lay of the land before you can think about acting in its confines. Why are you there? What do you want? What do they want? Why? You must be able to summarize a situation in a way that your counterpart will respond with a "that's right." If they don't, you haven't done it right. Section 3. Labels, Accusation Audit. Prepare 3 to 5 labels to perform an accusation audit. Anticipate how your counterpart feels about these facts you've just summarized. Make a concise list of any accusations they might make, no matter how unfair or ridiculous they might be.